Hello. In this audio snippet, we are embarking on a new topic. And now that we have talked about the 10 pillars of the new American Constitution, we're going to start talking a little bit about the political system that will be built around it. And I guess we can call this the castration of the current political party system. So in order to build a more perfect union, we have to destroy the current party system. And what conservatives are always doing is, in a sense, trying to live with the system because it was inherited from our founding fathers, and it's been in our history from the very beginning of the foundation of the nation. It's just accepted as the way things are. And conservatives then say, okay, that's the right way to go, but it has a few quirks, a few issues, and they try to put quick fixes on them, thinking, or propose quick fixes, thinking that that will solve the problem. And that kind of reminds me of a story that I saw when I was a kid on a cartoon episode. I vaguely remember the cartoon, and I think the cartoon is based on an old fable. And more or less, the cartoon had to do with a farmer that had a mice or a rat problem in the farm. And in order to deal with the mice problem, he brought in a whole bunch of cats. So the cats went in, and you know, they did their thing, and they ate up the mice. But once they ate up the mice, they, you know, started breeding and doing all that. And then the farmer ended up with a cat problem, and the cats all over the place and eating the flowers or whatever cats do. And so he said, I have to get rid of the cats now. So he brought in a whole bunch of dogs, and the dogs were successful in, you know, scaring away all the cats. But then the farmer had a dog problem. Dogs were running rampant all over the place and breeding, and they got out of control as well. So he said, I have to get rid of the dogs. And he didn't know how, so he brought in a whole bunch of lions. And the lions effectively, you know, scared away all the dogs. But then the lions started running, you know, roaming about the farm and eating, you know, killing the cows and the pigs and doing all sorts of mayhem. And the farmer said, I have to get rid of these lions. And so he brought in some elephants, because I believe elephants are the only animal that lions fear, if you can call that fear, or at least respect. So he brought in a whole bunch of elephants to get rid of the lions, and effectively the elephants scared away all the lions. But then he started having a problem with all the elephants running around the farm, you know, stomping on the crops and you know, leaving manure where they're not supposed to. So it became this big problem. And he said, okay, how do I get rid of the elephants? And then he, you know, found out, you know, the old fable, or I don't know how real this is, but, you know, he, at least in the story, you know, that the famous belief that elephants are scared of mice. So he said, okay, I have to get rid of these elephants. So he brought in a whole bunch of mice to get rid of the elephants. So he ended up where he started. And that's more or less what conservatives do all the time. That's their modus operandi. They see a problem, they look for a quick fix, and the fix introduces more problems because the quick fix never dealt with the underlying issue, because they were too proud or too blind or too stubborn to understand or recognize the root issue. So we are going to try to dismantle the whole system and rebuild it correctly. Instead of trying to do these little fixes and pretending that we can live within this current political party system, what we have to do is castrate it and make it impotent, incapable of producing any sort of power. That's what impotence means, lack of potency, lack of power. So we have to castrate the political party system. that is currently in place in America. Otherwise, having a new constitution is going to be irrelevant because it's going to get trampled on eventually. That's what we're going to talk about in this audio clip. And so the first thing is something that we've already talked about before, and it's the fact that under the new American Constitution, which will have a single House of Representatives, it's going to be unicameral, a unicameral legislature. In this House of Representatives, political affiliation is going to be irrelevant. In other words, when you get elected, you don't get elected as a Democrat or a Republican. Maybe you have that label on you because that's kind of your thinking. You think like a Democrat or a Republican. So you will be maybe recognized as such when you get elected. But once you're elected, your affiliation is irrelevant. Currently, it isn't. Right now, if more Democrats get elected than Republicans in the House of Representatives, that means that they can elect the Speaker of the House. Then the Speaker of the House, who will be a Democrat in this case, will then start appointing committee chairmanships to Democrats. And then the Democrats start running the whole show. So now that they control the committees, then a bill that's related to a certain area has to be approved by this committee that's controlled by this chairman appointed by this Democrat speaker. And this Democrat chairman can then kill bills that will never see the light of day, the House floor to be voted on, because he decided that he does not want that bill, and he may not want that bill because a company that doesn't like that bill has talked to him through the network of lobbying, corrupt lobbying that happens in Washington, and has told him, hey, if you kill that bill, then we will give a very big, certain companies will give you a very generous donation. So you create this political corruption. It's all embedded. But under the new American Constitution, when someone gets elected to the House of Commons, as it shall be called, then they're no longer affiliated to any party. They may think like people of a certain group, like a Democrat or like a Republican, and they may vote and draft bills as such. But within the new system of the House of Commons, there won't be any relevance to them being of a certain thinking tendency. There's not going to be a Speaker of the House controlling committees, and as we explained in detail in previous audio clips, the creation of bills is going to be very organic. Any person can decide to draft a bill and post it on some board, which will, with the current technology, can be some sort of website, a public board, and then all the other members, all the other MCs, as we were calling them, members of Commons, MCs. All these other MCs are going to, be able to see that, bill that just got posted, and they can give it a thumbs up. And whatever the bills that get the most thumbs up, then go up the queue, you could say. And the bills the bill that gets to the top of the queue, the one with the most thumbs up, then gets voted on the floor. So it will be a matter of each MC doing their homework in the sense of running around the halls of the House, trying to promote their bill. So it won't be that they have to go kiss the butt of a certain committee chairperson, or kiss the butt of the Speaker of the House, or try to kiss the butt of the chairman of their party so that he or she can then, move things around and get the bill going. It will be a matter of them convincing their fellow MCs that their bill is a good idea. And that's how the system will work. And there will be a referee, as we explained before, who will be more or less monitoring the bills that and trying to enforce certain very objective parameters on the bills to ensure that the bills always fulfill certain constitutional requirements. But he or she will not be a voter, and will just be like a referee in a game, just applying rules in a very objective way with no power of his or her own. That person who will be the referee, the House referee, the HR, as we were calling him or her, will just be there to enforce the rules and will have no voting power, him or herself. So that will be the first step, you could say, of stripping the power of the political parties. Once a person of a certain persuasion, political persuasion, gets elected, the party or the group of people who were supporting him or her lose control of him or her. It's like they push him to Washington, and once the person is in Washington, he or she is his or her own person. So yeah, they may say I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, or I'm a, astronomy advocate or whatever, persuasion they have, they can still identify themselves as such, but there's not going to be an organization controlling them from the outside. So that's the first step. The second thing, which might seem like it's not related to what we're talking about, is something we also briefly mentioned before, which has to do with limiting the salaries of all government employees throughout the entire government system at all levels. And we mentioned before that the Constitution will have a certain limit, a very clear limit, that no person working in public service can make more than 1.5 times the national household average. So if the average household in America, for example, makes $60,000 a year, then no government employee in that year will be able to make more than $90,000, which is 1.5 times $60,000. More than $90,000 a year, from the president all the way down to the janitor of the lowest office. Everyone will be limited to that maximum of $90,000. And that means that if they want to increase their salary, the only way to do it will be to institute policies that improve or provide economic freedom and economic growth. And then their salaries will naturally increase. And if they do stupid things that that hamper the economy in some way, then their salaries will go down. Or if we have some sort of national catastrophe or something where we all become poorer through no fault of anyone's, then yes, they all will have to share in the pain. Their salaries will naturally decrease. But they will be kind of like in tune with what's going on with the country, because right now they live in this kind of a Mount Olympus, separate from the rest of the plebeians, living in their own privileged world. But if their salaries are tied to what's going on in the country on an everyday or yearly basis, then they will be much more aware of what's going on and feel much more accountable. And obviously, the salary of the next year is based on the national average, statistically calculated from the previous year, and that's how it will work. And you would say, well, how does that have to do? How does that affect the political party system? What happens is, political power is a very much related to monetary power. People who get into this political power game are people who enjoy the perks of that political power. And that includes monetary gratification, if you can call it that. And if they know that constitutionally they will not be able to enrich themselves in any significant way by doing public service, because that's what they're supposedly doing, public service, when working for the government, then you will automatically filter out the people who are there out of ambition. People who are driven by ambition, if they know that that type of a job doesn't really pay much, will not be as inclined to pursue that line of work as someone who is more, let's say, idealistically oriented, someone who has ideals and principles and who believes in causes and ideas. Those people will say, oh, I don't care, and you know, that's okay. And if they really, you know, they say, I can't live on $90,000 a year, then don't work for the government. Don't be a public servant. Go do something else in the private sector and earn your money there, because in the private sector, you have to earn it. So they have to go out and sweat it out and achieve their wealth if they really want to be wealthy. But they're not going to make them make money off of the backs of the public. So 1.5 times the national household average as maximum. And that will filter out a whole bunch of politically ambitious people and will help to in the castration of the political party system. So under this scenario, there's not going to be any like people like this son of a bitch, Tony Fauci, the one that has been promoting all the plandemic at the time of this recording. If I'm not mistaken, he makes like around $350,000 or $400,000 a year, or he makes a ton of money, which is sort of sad that, you know, that the American public are paying a bastard like him to institute policies that are killing people, destroying economies, destroying lives, and enslaving people. So it's very sad that we have a situation like that. A son of a bitch like that little bastard boy should not be making more than $50,000 a year. And actually, he owes us money. And he will pay when he burns in hell for all of eternity to no end. So, but the sad thing is that, you know, between now and, you know, within 5 years, he'll be dead and burning in hell. That during that span, he will still be making all that money and enriching him or herself, himself off of the American people, aside from all the extra money he's making with his deals with the injection companies and all that evil research. So, so this limitation on the salaries will help to reduce the pool of people that are in it for the money and the power. And one thing that must be emphasized is this salary of 1.5 times, you know, the national average, household average, has to be the nominal amount with no perks, no benefits. Not like, oh, okay, you're going to make 90,000, but you're going to have a free house and a free car and free trips to Hawaii, you know, none of that. Just that's all you get. Nothing else. No benefits. That's all you make. At the most, 90,000. And I'm saying 90,000, assuming a 60,000 a year national average, household average. And no perks and no pension. No pension. Oh, but how are they going to retire? Well, you know, if they don't know what they're going to do with their lives after they're done, you know, doing government work, then they should probably not be in government. Simple as that. No pensions. Nothing like, I'm going to retire, work in Washington for 27 years, and then, you know, live off of this horrible, horribly privileged pension. Like, for example, Tony Fauci, from what I have heard, he's on his way to, you know, when he retire supposedly, you know, but he will die very soon. You know, son of a bitch will die within 5 years. But you know, if he ever makes it, you know, to an old age, he's slated to become the highest paid retired employee in American history, which is kind of like mind blowing to think that that we have such a stupid system that a bastard like him gets rewarded the most, more than any other person in American history. But under the new American Constitution, there will be no pension, nothing. You do your time, and if you feel that's not enough for you to retire, then just go work in the private sector. And if you think, oh no, I'm sacrificing myself for the country and how this is so unfair. Well, yes, that's exactly it. You're sacrificing yourself for the country. And if you're not willing to make the sacrifice, you shouldn't be there. Simple as that. So no perks, no pension, nothing like that. And they will also have to pay taxes exactly like everybody else. Nothing like, oh, he's a government employee, so he gets these tax exemptions. No. The same laws that are applied to all of us are applied to us. And in the case of the tax laws, as we have tried to explain in detail before, the tax system is going to be very simple. It's going to be a flat percentage above a minimum subsistence level. So let's say that the subsistence level is like, let's say, $36,000 a year, then whatever you make above $36,000, the government can take away a certain percentage, up to 20%. There's going to be a limit on that percentage. It's going to be a flat percentage, and that's going to be it. And there's going to be some other possible taxation systems that will be constitutionally valid, but we won't go into those details. We tried to explain that ad nauseum before, but it's going to be relatively simple. They won't be able to tweak with the tax system and try to create this tax mess that we have now. So to a certain extent, what I'm saying right now is a little irrelevant, but the thing is that they will not be able to make any sort of exemption of themselves regarding taxes. If everybody's paying a 17% flat tax above over any income above $36,000, that's exactly what they'll be paying as well. No more, no less. And then none of that. And that'll be written into the Constitution. And this is all related to what we described as the third pillar of the new American Constitution, where authority does not use the power from that authority for personal gains. And this will ensure that they won't be doing that. And another thing that is important within the salary limitation is also the limitation of staff. And this is very important for the MCs, that I believe it should be constitutionally written down that no MC, no member of Commons, of the House of Commons, will be allowed to have more than 5 assistants. So, because right now, every congressperson has a staff of like 5 gazillion people, and they're all making tons of money. And then there's a lot of nepotism and a lot of other stuff going on. Well, the thing is, every MC will only have a maximum of 5 assistants, and none of them can be related to them. No relatives, no nothing. If they want their wives or their husbands or whatever to work as assistants by their side, they can do it. Yeah, it's their choice, but they'll have to do it for free. But if they want to get paid, they can't be related in any way to them. So no nepotism, no way of getting around the $90,000 limit. Like say, okay, well, I'm not just going to make $90,000, but I'm going to hire my wife as my secretary, my assistant, and she's going to make $89,999. So between the two of us, then we go beyond the limit of $90,000. None of that. So a maximum of 5 assistants, a limited group. If they can't do it with 5 people, then they shouldn't be in Washington. And the thing is, they can get 1 assistant for free. If they want 2 assistants, they'll have to pay out of their salary 1.5%. So in other words, if they want 4 assistants, the first one will be free. The other 3 will mean that they will have a decline, a reduction of 4.5%, 3 times 1.5, 4.5% in their salary. So if they want all 5 assistants, they'll have to take a 6% cut in their salary. So if they want to get their job, if they don't, and that will incentivize them to not hire as many people. So if they want to make as much money as possible, if that's that important to them, they'll have to do their job with just one assistant, and that'll be it. So these limitations will create a certain culture, a certain environment of people that are there to work, to give of themselves for the sake of others, and not there to empower themselves. And that will, that that very subtle thing, which seems unrelated to the political party system, will do a lot to destroy that whole corrupt structure that we have right now. A third thing that we is important in this castration of the political party system is that candidates will only be allowed to receive donations from individuals. No donations from companies, no donations from organizations, from unions. That's a very corrupt source of income for political candidates. They ingratiate themselves with unions, and with the union bosses mostly, and then they get the union bosses to give them money from the union. And that's very unfair for a lot of reasons, because if you're sometimes you're forced to be in a union, and you're paying your dues to this forcible union, and that should be illegal and unconstitutional, but that's another story. But the thing is that these people are giving money to the union, and they might be Republicans, but the majority of, you know, of the board controlling the union is Democrat, so they're almost always Democrats. And they end up giving money from you, you who paid, as a Republican, let's say, paid your dues into the union because it was supposed to be for you, for the union, and then you have the union giving that money away to a candidate that you're completely opposed to. And that is unfair and unrighteous. And this is, it's in a sense, a violation of the 10th pillar, the fifth right, the right to a personal domain, because it's saying it's depriving you of the authority to decide what laws are going to rule the land, and it's using your domain, your property, your hard-earned income to support something you don't want to support. And the same with companies. A company should not be allowed to donate to a candidate for a lot of reasons. Obviously, that also, removing that prevents companies supporting a candidate so that they can legislate to the company's profit, and it also, it's unfair in the sense that if the company has this money available, why not give it back to the employees? Why are they then, like, basically not giving it to the employees and giving it away to a candidate? In a sense, it's as if the employees are, in a way, forcibly contributing to a candidate that they may not like. So only donations from individuals, donations from organizations will be prohibited. And there's also, you know, the issue, you know, as Hannibal Lecter would say, you know, the quid pro quo, Clarice, quid pro quo, that if you allow an organization or whatever it is to give to a candidate, there's always this thing that they can coordinate. I will give you this money in exchange for this, that, and the other. With individuals, it becomes much more difficult because, you know, we have 1 million different people giving money to you. You'd have to coordinate with 1 million different people to say quid pro quo on this, on that, and the other. And in a sense, you're doing that because they are giving you money in exchange for you voting a certain way, but it has to be kind of in a generic way in terms of principles and ideas, not in terms of, oh, okay, you vote for me, give me this money, and I will make sure that you will be able to get that house for free, because I'm going to pass a bill that will allow you to get that house for free. You know, that those little particular deals are much more difficult if you have to deal with 1 million individuals giving you money as opposed to one big organization giving you money. So that will help to destroy the power of political groups and organizations influencing candidates and elected servants. There's going to be a maximum on how much each individual can donate. And I dare say, this is just a suggested percentage, but I would suggest a maximum percentage of 0.5% of the national household yearly average. So in other words, let's say that the national household average income is $60,000 a year, then 0.5% of that comes out to, I believe, if I'm doing my numbers correctly, to around $300. So that would mean that any individual can only donate a maximum of $300 to a given one specific candidate. Obviously, they can give $300 to three different candidates if they want to, but each individual candidate on a given year can only get a maximum of $300 from a given individual. Even though the percentage is calculated based on national household averages, the donations can be given by every adult in a family if they want to donate separately. Let's say the husband is a Republican and the wife is a Democrat. Even though they earn a joint income, they can still give separately up to $300. Let's say, one to the Republic, to a quote Republican-minded candidate, and the wife maybe $300 to the quote Democrat-minded candidate. But still, there's going to be that limit. No donations from political action groups. None of that. Now that doesn't mean that. People cannot organize to support a candidate. They can do that, just not financially. So they can, let's say, organize to contribute to a person's campaign. Maybe they can decide, we really love this candidate, let's get together, let's form this group that will go and try to earn support for this candidate and do, the walking around the neighborhoods and trying to talk to people, go from door to door, offering pamphlets and trying to convince people to vote for this candidate and so forth. But it must be done independently of the candidate. They cannot be coordinating with the candidate. And if they do coordinations, if the candidate is coordinating these groups of people and telling them what to do and how to do it, there should be criminal penalties. Financial and criminal penalties. In other words, people going to jail, including the candidate, if they coordinate with these groups. The groups have to organically build themselves and organize themselves and do it. They can have, talk to the candidate and say, hey, we're working for you or helping you here, but you have to come talk to us and explain to us how things, how you will be doing things, because we want to explain to the people what you plan to do, so please explain it to us. So that's not coordination in that sense. It's just them kind of agreeing, getting together with the candidate to understand him and or her, and the candidate will, maybe stand in front of them and give them a speech and explain to them what he thinks and what he will be doing and so forth. But no coordination of, okay, now you're going to do this, that, and the other, because then a lot of backdoor stuff can start happening. If that coordination happens, it has to be independent, organic. If people really love this candidate, they will organize themselves and go and support him. And any money used by these groups must be obtained through voluntary contributions that the contributors know is intended for the given candidate. So they're not going to be able to pull money in and then, use it to support some candidate. So if this group goes and buys 300,000 pamphlets, that money used for that has to come from people who, and let's say the pamphlets are for candidates, let's say two candidates, candidates A and B running in like separate races. So they are giving, printing these pamphlets for these two candidates, A and B. That money that was used for that has to come from people who explicitly said, I am doing this to support candidate A, and I'm doing this to support candidate. So it has to be very, very clear and very transparent. So people will contribute money. If they contribute money into the camp, into this group, they will say, this money is for candidate A. And that money will only be usable for candidate A. And if it's used for candidate B, there'll be financial and possibly criminal penalties constitutionally established that, you know, on misusing that. So everything has to be very transparent, very voluntary in terms of money and so forth. And this is so that companies cannot use this these groups as a loophole to donate to a candidate. And a profit-making company cannot solicit donations for a specific candidate or a group that supports a candidate. So, yes, we've said, okay, companies cannot donate to a candidate, but they cannot do any backdoor support of, like, maybe on their company meeting saying, hey, we, you know, like the CEO standing up in front of the whole a company in some sort of big meeting and saying to the employees, hey, we really, really encourage you to vote for candidate A because candidate A is this, that, and the other. The CEO can go out and support candidate A on his own, you know, on his own time and dime, but he can't go, he can't tell the employees, hey, we really would love for you to vote for this candidate or solicit donations. Hey, we can't give to him, but we really encourage you to give to this specific candidate. That would be illegal, unconstitutional, and with potential criminal penalties. And that has to be written into the Constitution. People can go to jail for violating this. And there can be, you know, limits on a minimum of 1 month in jail or 2 months in jail. Something very clear, at least a very clear minimum of penalty, of jail penalty, for these violations. So so where does this leave, you know, the parties per se? As you can see, hopefully, this will, all these measures that we have described so far will have just kind of deprived or stripped the political parties of the power that they currently have. So will there be no parties anymore? Well, I would say that they will still exist. But these parties can be like think tanks that promote ideas and that endorse candidates, and they can actively work to support a candidate, but they cannot coordinate with the candidate. They cannot contribute financially to that candidate. So these are the groups that we were talking about, people coordinating. So it's like a more organic thing. And if you want to think of a think tank like within the American landscape currently at the time of this recording, you can think of something like the Heritage Foundation, this conservative think tank that is well known in political circles. The Heritage Foundation, you know, has these people who are there thinking and writing articles, posting things online and trying to promote ideas and things like that. And that's what the think tanks, the parties should become. Like political think tanks that have these websites and these people who are promoting ideas. And if you want to donate to a political think tank, you know, it's just like people donate to the Heritage Foundation, you can do so. You know, you want these people who are, you know, sitting there all day thinking ideas, and you know that they're thinking within a certain school of thought, like the Austrian School of Economics or whatever, you know, then just go ahead. You're free to donate to these groups, and they will, but they can't, you know, then take that money and donate it to a candidate, because all donations have to come directly from individuals. As you can see, the parties can exist. So there can be like a Democrat and a Republican party, and they can have a platform and a way of thought, you know, that we believe in these ideas, we're for this, we're for that, we're for the other. It's all in terms of ideas. There's no quid pro quo from any candidate. The Heritage Foundation cannot tell a conservative candidate, even if they support him, even if they do a lot to enable that person to, you know, become elected. They can't go and tell him or her, hey, you have to vote a certain way, or we're going to withdraw, you know, money from you. There's no quid pro quo. Yes, obviously they can say, hey, if you vote a certain way, we're not going to support you anymore. We're not going to write in favor of you, articles in favor of you. And yes, there is a certain quid pro quo in that sense, but it's a very subtle one. And it's a valid, I would say, quid pro quo, because that's what a democratic system is about, that you get elected and your election depends on you representing the ideas of the people who voted for you. So there has to be a quid pro quo in that general sense, but not in terms of power. Like, if you don't vote for this bill, then we're not going to give you money, or we're not going to give you that house, or, you know, things like that. So it's going to be very idea oriented, and these parties will then have absolutely no direct power in Washington. They can influence ideas and be the promoters of thought trends, as I would call it, you know, trends of thought. But they can't have control over who gets elected to a certain committee chairmanship that will then control, you know, what happens with energy bills or foreign affairs bills and stuff like that. So that's how parties will act under the new American Constitution. All that we're saying right now will be written in the Constitution. Where do platforms stand? Like, right now, you have every party has their platform. You know, this group of ideas that they stand for, and blah blah blah. And will there be platforms? In a sense, there will be, but there will be at the candidate level. So every candidate must make a contract with his or her voters, the idea is that every candidate will stand before the public and make some sort of a promise, but it's going to be a promise that's more than just words. It's going to be written somewhere and established that if you elect me, I promise to do this. And it's kind of similar to what happened in 1994, if I'm not mistaken, with Newt Gingrich and the contract with America. At that time, Newt Gingrich came up with this brilliant idea that he said, okay, we're going to say to the American people, if you vote for us, we're going to do this, this, that, and then the other when we get to Washington. And he drafted this list of promises, and he called it the Contract with America. And they got elected, and they did a lot of good things. It was around that time that we finally had a balanced budget, and I think we even had surpluses for a couple of years. I vaguely recall the 90s; they're kind of a blur to me. But the thing is that it really, really helped to have people who were there on a mission, and who felt obligated to fulfill certain very specific, clear promises. And every candidate will be required in a way to write a list of promises. They can say, yeah, I'm not promising anything. So they're not obligated to promise anything. But it's going to be like very a fundamental part of the political system, where if a candidate is not promising anything, if you go to their webpage, and there's going to be this official, it's going to be a official list of promises that is going to be legally binding. And I mean that literally, legally binding. If you go to their website and you see that their contract is blank, then that means that guy saying, vote for me, but when I get there, I'll do who knows what. But if you want, you know, if they start singing the ABBA song, Take a Chance on Me, Take a Chance on Me, then and people want to take a chance on him, then, you know, it's like like Russian roulette. They'll vote for him, and who knows what he'll do. But at least they'll know this guy is making no promises. And there will be others who will make this list of promises, and there will be two types of promises. And they have to be categorized that way. One is I'll try promises, and the other is I'll do promises. Because there are certain things you can only try to do. You can't, you know, like, for example, when you see that on crime shows where, you know, somebody is victimized in some way, and then the cops, you know, the detectives come in as they talk to the victim, and then they say, I promise I will catch the guy. And you have my promise. And when you listen to that, you go, well, how can he promise that? I'm sure he's going to do his very best to catch the criminal, but he can't guarantee that he'll be able to do it, because even if he catches him, who knows what will happen when the case goes to trial? Will they have enough evidence? Will he get off on a technicality? So many things outside of the control of that detective. So there are certain things where you cannot say, I will do this, because it's contingent on many other external factors. So you can say, you can only try. So and the problem with trying is that it's a very subjective thing. So he can say he tried, but maybe he just pretended like he was trying and really didn't do anything. But at least that promise will be there with the label, I will try. So you know, hey, he's not promising to do it. He says he will try his very best, but maybe his best will not be good enough, you know, like the song would say. And people will know that. So this is like a promise at a lower level. And then there will be the I will do promises, things that can be concretely evaluated as having been done or not done. You know, it's like saying, I'm going to move these bricks from here to here. You know, how do you know whether you fulfilled the promise? Well, you just have to look around. Are the bricks where you promised they would be, or are they still in the same place? Or maybe you moved half of them, but you can see it. You can see whether the promise was fulfilled or not. And so there'll be two types of promises in this contract that every candidate will make with their voters. And once it's, and maybe it can fluctuate as the election, as the campaign goes along, they're free to kind of switch around. But once election comes and they get elected, that contract is set in stone. And there will be, again, financial and or criminal penalties if you don't fulfill the promises. And if, let's say, that something happens and you promise something, and once you get elected, you realize that was the most stupid promise you could have ever made. And maybe the voters realize that was a stupid promise and they regret having supported you, you know, in making this promise. Then there can be like a mutual regret type of thing. So a candidate can say, hey, I promised to do this in my contract, but let's have a special election. And that's how relevant these promises will be, that they can even trigger unscheduled elections, and say, let's have some sort of voting. And now with the technology we have online and everything, this all can be done very, very smoothly and very transparently, as long as there's no Dominion voting system from those sons of bitches, white liberal Democrats. If we have a transparent system, things can be worked out very smoothly, but we can have like a special election or some special voting where you can ask the voters, do you release me from this promise? And if more than 50% of the total vote supports releasing the candidate from the promise, then he is free. And say, okay, then he can go ahead and do something else. But it's going to be a very explicit thing. So that's more or less the contract system that we'll have. And there's no need for parties. It's everything individual. I hope you are noticing through these audio clips, the focus in all of this is the individual. The voting, the bills, the drafting of the bills, everything is based on individuals. Individual voters, individual candidates, individual people with individual ideas, organically forming a more perfect nation. So now that we've talked about that, Len, let's talk a little bit about the voting system per se. The voting system for MCs, for the members of the House of Commons, the members of Commons, will no longer be by district. Currently in the American system, every state is divided into districts, and then each district elects a representative to the House. So a big state will have more districts than a small state. And I think I could be wrong with this, but I think there's some sort of parameter to decide how many people a district can have and so forth. But the thing is that that leads to the famous gerrymandering problem. And I don't know how common that term is outside the U.S., but gerrymandering refers to this idea of redrawing districts to get more people from your party elected. So, for example, if let's say that you have a very Republican neighborhood, that you know, a very Republican district that is surrounded by, let's say, three very Democrat heavy districts. What Democrats like to do is that they like to split that Republican district, or kind of like redistribute the four districts in such a way that all the Republican, that whole Republican sector gets swallowed, you know, in parts into the other three districts, if you know what I mean. So then you have, instead of having three Democrats in one Republican district, you end up having four Democrat, majority Democrat districts, because the Republican sauce was kind of distributed in the rest of the districts. And because the idea is that whoever gets the most votes in the district wins. So it doesn't matter if I get 50.1% or 99%. So they do this gerrymandering where they artificially redraw the districts so that you know, they get enough majority in each district to then get more people elected to their party. And both parties are guilty of that. But I've noticed, it's almost always the Democrats doing that sort of dirty stuff. And so we'll take that away. There's no need to worry, because it's all very arbitrary. How do you decide where a district ends and another one begins? Why does it end here or there? So let's get rid of that. And the new American Constitution will have a system that will be completely at the state level. So, and a state's representation will still be proportional to its population. But we're going to have like a system where you get the top candidates from the voting at the entire state level. And you would say, well, isn't that unfair, let's say, to the little towns and the little districts? Well, yes and no. Well, actually, no. The answer is really no. Because what happens is, if a certain town feels left out, a certain area of the state feels abandoned, what will happen is that that will naturally promote candidates who will say, "Hey, I'll stand up for you," and that means that that little district is going to vote exclusively for their local candidate, whom they probably know or are very much aware of. So he will get a disproportionately high amount of votes compared to other candidates who are in more fought out districts throughout the rest of the state, if that makes any sense. So their chances of getting elected become higher if they're, the people in their district get together and kind of unite their votes in favor of one specific person. So it will be very organic. And the system will be that any person can submit their names to be candidates. There's because there's no party anymore. It's not like I have to go through the party system and start kissing butts and sleeping with people and prostituting myself to rise through the ranks. No, anyone. It's kind of like what happens in California recall elections here in the U.S., where you know all these sorts of crazy people, you know, say I want to be governor. I want to be governor. So. And you hear these actors and actresses trying to, you know, use their fame, take advantage of their name recognition and say, yeah, I want to be the next governor. So anyone can submit their names, and they don't have, so they, and there'll be the system where they will be able to log in or something and say, okay, I'm submitting my name. I'm saying, hey, I want to serve in, you know, public office. And believe you me, with the things we said at the beginning of this audio clip, it will not be anyone who will want to do that. It will be a certain type of person with a certain personality, a certain spirit of sacrifice and dedication and idealism. So not everybody's going to be, you know, deciding to become a candidate, because it's going to be work. You know, they're not going to have the limousines and all the perks that these people have, as we said before at the beginning. It's going to be just very work oriented. So, but anyone can say, I will submit my name. So they put their name into the system. And that means, okay, he is available, he or she is available to be elected. And that list will be publicly available on the web. So if someone who you know, is only known by his uncle and his aunt and his grandma, and they're the only people that will vote for him, he can put his name on the system, but it's not going to go anywhere. No one's going to know who he is, and no one's going to vote for him except for his grandma and I forget who else I said. But maybe I'm not well recognized. Put my name there, but then you know, it's up to me to do the groundwork and go to my neighbors and start promoting myself. So it's going to be a very democratic system, not the republic system the conservatives are always kind of so proud of. We have to turn it into a more democratic system, not a Democrat system, God forbid, a democratic system. So it's the candidate's responsibility to be known. And what happens is everyone who submits their name to be a candidate in the election will automatically get an ID. So it's like they get a like a number or something. And what they have to do is go tell their potential voters what their ID is so they can vote for him or her. It's kind of like the way American Idol was, and I've been hearing that apparently American Idol is going to come back, because right now American television has run out of ideas. So we're constantly recycling old shows over and over again, like Hawaii Five-O should have never been recreated. Why do they mess with the original? But the thing is, American Idol, when it used to be around, used to have this thing where you could a candidate would say, "Vote for me, call this number to support me." So it's like every candidate had a number, and it's going to be similar. Every candidate will have an ID, and as your campaign, you're going to say, "Remember, my ID is so and so." And when you vote, you say you will go and vote for that ID, and that's how it will happen. And I know that this would have been much more difficult in the past. We could have done a simple version of this. From a long time ago. So this was doable. But now with the technology that we have, the internet and all that, this is much more doable and much more dynamically achievable. What will happen is when the election day comes, people will be allowed to decide to vote for their five favorite candidates, number five, number four, number three, number two, number one. And it will be like a ranked voting system. And as I was thinking about these things last year, thinking about how this could be explained in an audio clip, And we never got a chance to do that until now. It was interesting to me that as I was thinking all of this, then I found out that New York City was implementing a ranked voting system. And it's a kind of a unique system. It's kind of complex in a certain way, but I said, wow, interesting that they're trying to do this as I'm thinking about these things. It's as if that kind of, in a sense, was something got stirred in the air and they started thinking that way. And I think they applied it in the last election, mayoral election. And but what we can do in the Constitution is a simpler version of that. What they were doing was that you could rank, you could vote up to, I forget, up to five maybe candidates, like your five favorite candidates in order. And then what happened would happen is whoever got the least first place votes would drop out. So as that candidate dropped out, then all the votes, the first place votes, let's say that, how can I say it? Let's say that my favorite candidate was A and my second favorite for it was B. Let's say that A got the least amount of favorite votes. So he's kind of eliminated. Then my vote becomes votes for B, if that makes any sense. And if B gets eliminated, then my third choice, my vote becomes, my, it's as if I had voted for C as the top candidate and so forth. And the system does this kind of a elimination process until you end up with just one winner. It's kind of a very intricate system, but very interesting. And I don't know if we would need to do that, but I think it would be constitutionally allowed. But the other system that we can implement is a much simpler version where you just give a point system. You know, your top candidate earns 5 points, your second top candidate 4 points, and so forth. And whoever gets the most points wins the election. And in the case of a state, let's say we're electing our representatives for our state, then let's say if our state has 100 representatives, then the 100 top point getters end up elected. And then districts that have larger populations will tend to vote for their people and will get more people in elected to the House. And the areas of the state that have fewer people will tend to get fewer of their people voted. But there will be a certain freedom. A person from a certain part of the state will be able to vote for people in another part of the state because we're choosing the best people to do the job. So there's more freedom and there's no worrying about gerrymandering and any of that. It's going to be very dynamic. And one thought that I had at the beginning, but this was before the redefining of the voting system, was that under the current system, people complain a lot about not having good choices when they go to vote. And while we are implementing this new system, we can kind of do a quick patch Band-Aid on the current system so that people should be allowed. Because right now what happens is the Republican Party offers a candidate, and usually it's a rhino, Republican in name only. And then a Democrat chooses a nut job, a communist liberal. So you go to vote and you have to choose between a rhino who's going to stab you in the back, and then a radical nut job Democrat that's going to send us over the cliff. And you go, okay, do I want to die a slow death or a quick death? And you go, okay, I'd rather die a slow death. And you choose the least of the two evils. And it shouldn't be like that. So because we're offered these choices, we have no other choice. So what should happen in that situation, I should say, hey, hell no, I don't want either of these. So you should be able to nullify your vote. And if 30% of the voters nullify their vote, both parties are obligated to offer new candidates. And yeah, we'll have no representative for a while. We'll have to wait for another election. But, you give us crap, we'll just, make you work for it until you give us something that's not crappy. So that'd be like a temporal band-aid while we fix this. And notice that this resolves this whole transformation that we're talking about ends the concern about term limits. And that's one of the, you know, band-aids that conservatives love to talk about. Oh, we should impose term limits. Well, first of all, wait a second. So you're saying that if I want to vote for someone, I can't vote for him anymore because you are telling me you're artificially imposing a time limit, a term limit on him. And maybe he's better than the next piece of crap that's coming along. Why am I going to vote for the piece of crap just because you're artificially retiring this guy? Oh, because we want to control, career politicians and all that. Well, we have career politicians because of the entire system. It's not because of term limits. See, that's the thing that we were saying at the beginning. It's trying to, you know, fix the mice by bringing in the cats. Then you bring in another problem with the cats, and then you have to bring in the dogs, and that's how we go. If he is better, let's say that we get the greatest person in the history of mankind, born in America, and he gets elected as a House of a member of the House of Commons, and he's doing a great job. And he eats well and exercises and lives a long, long time. No dementia, no problems. He can, let's say he lives 120 years. And he provides 90 years of exemplary service. Why would you want me to vote for someone else? He's perfect. So term limits are metaphysically unsound. If the same person gets elected over and over and over again, and it's the same piece of crap getting elected over and over again, then there's something wrong with the whole system. Then we have a system that is enabling this crap to keep coming up over and over and over again because people have no other choice. And because these people are constantly kissing the butt of political party chair people, and kissing the butts of companies and this and that, and that's how they maintain their power and their campaign strength. So we should destroy all of that. Then we don't have to worry about term limits. Then the best people will stay and the bad people will be voted out. So that's what angers me about conservatives. They only think short-term, stupid short-term solutions, because they're excessively practical instead of thinking metaphysically, instead of thinking conceptually. And that's why we have the mess we have in this country. We have a whole bunch of idiotic conservatives stuck in the past, unwilling to break the mold because they love the mold too much. And then that vacuum of change is filled by all these bastards who want change, the liberals, the white fascist liberals who want change that absolutely destroys the country. So I hope that what we've described here has been clear, and this is more or less a synopsis of how the political system will be transformed, how we can castrate the current political party system and create a partyless, relatively partyless system that will serve the people and do the truth, carry out the truth. And so thank you very much for listening.